Terrence Masson, welcome. Thank you so much for being here on 8111. It's great to reconnect with you. I can't think of the last time I saw you. It might have been back at ILM way back in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's a great concept you have here. Maybe it was,
thanks.
I don't know. We worked on a bunch of stuff together, I know. At least according to IMDb, right? If not my aging failing memory. No, it's in episode one, Phantom Menace, right? One of the last ones. And you'll remember, and anyone of our friends at ILM will remember, names are so familiar more than faces because of the paging system, right?
T-Man. I remember T-Man too, your email handle, I believe.
Right. That's true. That's still
your nom digger.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, it's like Matt Wallen to see theater. And you hear that for 4 years and you're like, who is this Matt Wallen?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, so, I'm super excited to talk to you. In sort of preparation, I was looking over your LinkedIn page and I have to say you have an amazingly, diverse and really interesting career. But first, I was kind of curious, where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in New York, but grew up outside of Boston. So from 73 until undergraduate school, I went to UMass for my BFA. My dad was a physician, so he's just retired. So when I was a baby and a young kid, we were moving all over the place during his residency. And then in the mid-late 60s, he was with a Navy research project for a while called Tektite 2. And I'm a lifelong scuba diver. So it was just so cool to know that. And I was there in diapers, but it was basically underwater habitats. He was a pulmonary doctor.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. So he basically did all the physical checkups and safety dives for these underwater habitat aquanauts, of which he was one. So that's super cool. But yeah, we settled in outside of Boston in 73.
And growing up around that, was that for you, was science was probably just part of the vernacular in your house, I would imagine?
It really was. Well, yeah, science, medicine, sci-fi. So he was just always a voracious reader. He taught me to play chess, reading Isaac Asimov, and all the old grandmasters. He took me to see Star Wars in 77.
Right on.
Right.
Were you a cinephile as a kid? Were you into movies?
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Hardcore. I mean, everything. Outside of Massachusetts, anyone around Boston will remember. In fact, I hear, Rob Zombie, who's from Boston, we'll talk about growing up on the Creature Double feature on Channel 56.
Oh, right on.
Saturday
cool.
night, 5 o'clock. Yeah, so all, Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. But yeah. I wasn't into the classic, highfalutin stuff until later. But
yeah. Did you have brothers and sisters growing up?
One younger sister. Yeah, she's an elementary school teacher now. Laurie is her name. Shrimpo, I've been calling her. So she's 3 years younger, and that's it. We grew up there. And when I finished my undergrad, quick jump forward, bounce all over. I lived all over the world. Toronto, back to New York, lived in India for a while, moved to LA, San Francisco, which we'll touch on related to my career stuff. But
that's definitely a big part of certainly the industry side of, I think, a lot of the work that you've been involved in is there has been a host of opportunities for people to really get to see all parts of the world. What was your undergraduate degree in?
Oh, what was the actual degree in? It was a BFA. I think the degree was actually graphic design with a minor in art history. It just came back to me. There we go.
were you in your BFA? Did you do work digital work, or were you working primarily in traditional media?
Both. So even then, I mean, even back in in the 70s in grade school, I was, hacking TRS-80 computers to do ASCII Star Trek games and stuff. So I,
really, so you were like an early like home computer.
I was
dude. That's cool.
A TD while still in diapers, right?
That's awesome. That's really early to get into that too, because that was kind of a little bit more unusual, I think, at that time.
It was, and even through like in high school, early '80s, I was at a private Catholic college prep high school that my parents sent me to that I was not happy about at all, because I was also in band my entire life, you know, musician, and the big deal in
what's your axe?
Oh, that's true. That's right. Reeds. So it was mostly clarinet growing up. Bass clarinet was, you know, jazz and classical orchestra.
Do you still play?
Not clarinet. No, I've been trying to get back or into piano with my son, who's 8 now, which I could talk for hours about. But so for middle school, the big deal was to go to the high school band, man. That was like when my parents said, well, guess what? You're not going to the big public high school to go in the marching band. You're going to this.
What?
I was like, what? But my point saying is that so in the convent, I'm not making this up, in the basement, they had a computer science class, and they had this big old, I don't know what it was, like a VAX mainframe with terminals, and they taught computer science in high school. So this was like 81.
That's crazy.
I know. So even then it was like, oh, I like this.
Just the foresight of somebody recognizing the value of that early.
Yeah.
And setting something like that up, especially in a school like that too. Like that's fascinating.
Yeah, and to your point about, you know, being relevant to students now, so when I was getting my BFA, it was meant to be it was a straightforward fine art degree. So I took photography from, black and white auteur master photographers, and graphic design and printmaking and sculpture and color theory. But it was, so when did I start my BFA? 85? And so the Apple, right? Apple computer,
yep.
84, 85.
Wow.
And then the Amiga.
That's so cool.
Yeah, then the Amiga 500 came out a couple of years after that. So before, I know from my BFA thesis, I ended up doing a color cycling animation with Deluxe Paint 2 on the Amiga to a Rush song, Red Barchetta, which you can Google up. It's still on YouTube someplace.
Oh, that is wild. So you really were like a sort of like an early comer to the universe of computer graphics and computer animation, it would seem. I mean, that's like, those are such early days. I always tell my students, I didn't even own a computer when I was an undergraduate in film school. And I typed all my papers on a one-line memory Brother typewriter. And I don't think I owned a computer until sometime after I started working at ILM, which is kind of, maybe I'm a late bloomer that way.
Yeah, that's all right. No, I guess you're right. And the timing was, I mean, I'm so incredibly grateful to have gotten to ILM just as, we might be jumping ahead too far, but just as T2 wrapped basically, and it was still, you know, a very
So you finished your bachelor's degree, and then you got your MFA at William Patterson University
in Jersey, and that was very. Here's a tip, kids. It was very an equal parts naivete and being really driven. So, growing up, Star Wars and seeing The Abyss and then hearing about T2 coming out, I just simply said, well, that's what I'm going to do. So I'm going to get a job at ILM and I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do live action visual effects stuff. And the fact that I did it was like, as I said, either, you know, complete naive or part driven. So the reason why I went to graduate the only reason I went to grad school was I found out that ILM used this thing called an SGI in this software called Alias. And I said, oh, it costs about $250,000 to buy that computer.
You won't be running that on your computer at home.
No. And for your viewers out there, I'm not making that number up. That's pretty accurate. So I said, oh, graduate school. So I found, basically in the late 80s, every graduate school in the country, which there were not many that had computer graphics programs, were all in computer science departments. because this stuff was just being imagined and written. So you had to get a CS degree to write a ray tracer based on a SIGGRAPH paper or something in order to make pictures. Mm-hmm. So there were two exceptions. Well, one being William Patterson was in an art department. So David Haxton had really put this thing together, and it was in a fine art department, and they had SGIs and Alias, and it was about a 4-hour drive from my house outside of Boston. So that's, I went to graduate school just to put together a demo reel to apply to ILM to get a job.
Wow. So you were like laser focused yeah. getting there.
Yeah.
And so how did you make that connection, like in the way that you wanted to after grad school or while you were still in school? Like how'd you close that loop?
So this is, you know, before the interwebs. Mm-hmm. You know, I would go to the public library and look up magazines of, it was, I'd have to even think back of what the periodicals were back in, like, you know, Computer Graphics World.
Yeah, sure.
And stuff. And they would list companies like, you know, R. Greenberg and Associates, Rhythm and Hughes, mm-hmm. And they with mailing addresses. So you could, you know, get mailing addresses and just call the front desk and ask to talk to people back then. So,
you know, that's something that's so interesting that you bring that up, because I've talked about that sometimes in class with students too, in referencing the fact that, you know, if I give students an assignment today and say, hey, you know, show me, you know, two or three artists whose work you're really excited about, and come prepared to give a presentation or something to your peers.
Right.
And they can go home and in, you know, 15 minutes, oh, they can, yeah, you know, do a Google research project, the depth of which, right, you know, you couldn't have done, no, sort of pre-internet age. Like that idea of having to go find old back issues of magazines, mm-hmm, and like combing through, like that's so kind of the analog version of kind of a database search. Like that research was so much more onerous and time consuming. And I think in some ways, maybe too, in those earlier kind of iterations, it was, you really kind of had to connect the dots on your own. You sort of had, yeah, to have that, mm-hmm, that ability to sort of understand that there was those, that there were those resources out there.
Oh, it's very true. And I think you just answered my conundrum, is that it's not that more people couldn't have gotten their dream job like I did. It just, I was able to visualize those dots and connect them to say, well, I know about ILM, so I got to find their mailing address and I've got a contact. And, you know, I did that. And it was Doug Kay and George Joblove who were running the department at the time.
Yep. Was that prior to the sale of Pixar or was that after?
No, that was after, because that, okay, yeah, Pixar sale was, what, like 84, something like that?
Is that right? Yeah, I don't remember.
And I didn't get there till early 91.
So you wrote to some of these places, and I see a really early entry on your, 1991 that's like really, it's teasing me. I'm so fascinated. How did that occur?
So I always was telling stories. I'm 50% Irish on my mom's side. So for me, that meant short animated films. That's just how I started using all these tools. So I made a couple of short animated films that went out to festivals, one of which ended up being the Mill Valley Film Festival to be a selection and screened. And that's, for those who don't know California, that's kind of a suburb of where ILM was in San Rafael. So that got noticed. So then the next time I called Doug Kay and said, hey, you know, I did a 3D CG short animated film with Alias on an SGI, and it's in a film festival that you can drive to. So that was what literally got me into the door and hired.
Was that contact with Doug? Was that something that, did you just cold call?
Oh, yeah, just called him up. Yep.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so they called the front desk, you know, in Kerner. Hi, you know, can I talk to whoever's in charge of computer graphics?
And he was, he really receptive to that?
Oh,
too?
Sure.
He, oh, like, he's pretty open?
Both those guys are I still stay in touch. They're just the greatest, most altruistic, friendly, professional guys, yeah, ever. And we got to, at that time, it was so small, the computer graphics group, we had a, went on a canoe trip, and the entire department just like got into canoes on this, you know, the Russian River, and just went canoeing. I think it might have been
50. Yeah, now you'd need a flotilla.
You'd need
right,
a cruise ship. Yeah, I think it might have been 50 people total, you know, including systems and support and the digital group.
That's cool. So you got hired and you came in and you did, you were archiving assets from Terminator 2, like backing stuff up on exabyte tape or something? Or?
No. So it was, I would, you know, literally had a physical clipboard that I would walk around and check with the TDs, because my title when I first got there was technical assistant. So to say, are you done with this shot? Can I offload it off of the DDR? It was all these digital disc recorder things, yep, that had very finite room, and you had to get, and they were doing commercials at the time, Pepsi Man and
oh right,
a whole bunch of other
I
stuff.
Remember Pepsi Man?
Yeah, it was great, right? And then just being voracious as I got there, I could have just done that and been extremely thankful to do that. But Sandy Ford, was my mentor, and she's just one of a long line of brilliant women who are in that industry, as you know, especially at ILM.
And she's still at Pixar, I think.
She is, right? Yeah. I think she's in story or in layout.
She's had an amazing career.
Oh, brilliant woman. Yeah, amazing. So, but yeah, just drawing, I still remember, like it was yesterday, drawing on her whiteboard in her office, the log linear conversion, you know, lookup table stuff. And I'm like, whoa, there's so much I don't know. But I just immediately got on the digital paint systems that Doug Smyth had written, you know, Deep Paint, to do wire removal stuff. Hook was the first actual film that I worked a lot on, did a lot of digital stuff on Hook.
And was that like mostly wire removal work, or were you doing, did you get to do some other work on that show?
No, tons of other stuff. It was so fascinating because there was just so much to do. They were like, you know, T-Man, can you, you know, hand animate some shadows of cloud on the clouds that Robin Williams is flying over down to Neverland, because the green screen element cut off his legs before he entered frame, and you know, the angle that the CG soup wants it to be, and if they animate. So there's a lot of effects animation, just hand by hand effects animation with the digital paint system in addition.
So generating 2D assets,
correct,
that you could then like manipulate, or were you actually doing keyframes for that, or how?
Yeah,
how
just hand by hand. Yeah, frame by frame, good old fashioned 2D effects animation, but happened to be using
that. Cool.
And the fascinating thing about this time was that the digital tools just were starting to be written. So I was doing hand animated frame by frame traditional effects animation pixie dust. Wes Takahashi was doing the same thing using an animation stand. So I was doing it digital. He was doing an analog. And I think, I forget who wrote the particle system. It was probably Doug again. But someone was using, just testing it out to do, there was a shot of the bridge at the, I think it was at the end, when the pixie dust comes down and it sprinkles on top of a couple and they start floating up. There were a couple of shots that used an actual early particle system too.
And that show was all, that was all filmed out to 35 millimeter too, right?
Oh yeah, for sure.
So when you were doing that kind of two-dimensional animation of doing some of those like effects animation stuff, were you, how were you able to view other than the still frames? Like could you cycle some of the frames, or did you have to wait to render those out and then see them composited? I think I know the answer, but
yeah, no, it's good for everybody listening to who, you know, have known nothing else than pure digital pipelines. You know, everything would be, the takes would be very carefully edited with handles and laser scans, so because it's very expensive and time consuming. So you would get your shot with like 10 frame handles on the live action plates, and those you could rock and roll and play with, you know, in-house. Everything was in-house custom tools, of course, for looping shots and sequences. And then in layer paint, you could load up, I would load up three frames at a time, and so the one that you're painting, the one before and the one after, and it just like flipping in the old Disney methodology.
Yeah, cell animation.
Yeah, cell animation. That's all you're doing. And you could offset them and paint through. And then when the take was done, you would have to film it out. And that's what you would see in dailies the next morning, is, or 2 days later, is you would actually see it projected in theater on film.
Right. Yeah, I remember like those early days of some of the compositing tools where you didn't have an interactive frame buffer that showed mm-hmm. all your layers combined. You would actually type numbers into a mm-hmm. header script and then run a header script on the yeah. farm and cross your fingers. And I can't remember what they called that. Was it just...
I think was it iComp? Or was there
and people jokingly called it MindComp. Because it was so you could enter a slight variable in part of the script and then pass it on, render it out, and see it the next day or on one of the mm-hmm. The playback devices, and then be like,
that's right,
it's totally way off, and you'd have to go back and tweak numbers. And so interesting in that sort of that age that was sort of just pre-visualization, where you really didn't have the mm-mm. power, even on those really expensive machines, mm-hmm. to be able to see what you were hopefully going to see at the end of the pipe.
That's right. Yeah, just a text interface, just typing along. But boy, it was just heaven, just pinching. I get misty eyed. I get so nostalgic because I went back. I get so lucky. I was invited to go to the 40th anniversary of the original ILM VFX crew.
Yeah, that looked really cool.
Star
I saw
Wars
pictures when they did that,
and of course it was at the old Kerner complex, Kerner. Right? So I. It wasn't closed or anything. It was out in the parking lot, but I separated myself and I walked into the building and up the staircase and into C Theater, and it smelled the same. I mean, those old like red velour couch chairs. And it was really moving. It was such a privilege to be.
It's interesting there. I think everybody kind of has like a there's an interesting nostalgia for people who pass through that place. Mm-hmm. Before, I mean, I've been to the new facility, which is so fancy and beautiful and everything, but there is this weird kind of maybe perverse nostalgia for that kind of real mm-hmm. upstart kind of grungy Kerner location, which was just a series of like industrial warehouse buildings, really.
Yeah, and if people aren't aware of that, it was literally in the Circuit City parking lot, right? I was down on the other side of the parking lot with... It just completely nondescript. And on the other end was the waste treatment plant right down in the end, of the end of the street. Yeah, it was
this very DIY kind of space where like everything was about something that I know I saw you had mentioned in your on your LinkedIn page here is just that real creative problem solving, like where you're presented with some complicated client request or some need or some technical hurdle. Mm-hmm. And, there's this kind of learning from your mistakes, like kind of just putting your head to the grindstone and figuring out, all right, how are we going to do this? How can we, let's try this. Oh, that didn't really work out. So, hey, I've got an idea. Let's try this,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it was so exciting and invigorating, but also just the normal. And, people who are younger than us will have known that the Mythbusters show and Grant Imahara, who just passed away so sadly, being an ILM alum, that's the kind of vibe. Was it's just things that had never been done before. I mean, being on pre-production on the original Jurassic Park was just the most extreme example, really, of this paradigm shift of, okay.
Hey, what was happening there on that initial kind of R&D group?
Well, the story's been told many times by Dennis and Spaz with.
But what was your role,
Stefan? Oh, well, I was just an observer more than anything, with being a part of the department at the time, hanging in the pit with Spaz and mm-hmm. playing his bagpipes and showing this animated T-Rex skeleton. Because I was just a green behind the ears technical assistant, doing animation at the time. But that was the subgroup that I gravitated with, Mark DePay and Spaz. And
do you remember at that time? Like, did you even as a young person? Were you confident that there was a solution that was coming? Like, could you see
Oh, sure.
it coming together where you sort of like, I don't know if this will work, you know?
Oh, no, absolutely. Again, it was probably that naivete. In fact, I'm sure I drove some people crazy with just being so positive and so naive and so altruistic and upbeat and friendly. I'm sure I annoyed the hell out of people and producers who were a little bit more grounded to say, whoa, dude, chill. It's, you know, it's like, we get it. It's going to be good. But that's my only excuse, is just I had such a positive, I mean, it was the dream job, right, back then, and it would be today for many people. So anyway.
Now, you weren't there that long when you, for that period of time. It was a little less than a year, it looks like. And then you went off and went back east. It looks like you went to work with Doug Trumbull's company.
I did. So that was purely family driven. So I had my first child, Chelsea, had just been born. So I tell my new wife with our new baby to say, we're in Massachusetts, I'm going to California to work for ILM. So it was only meant to be, you know, one project. It was basically specifically on Hook. And a bunch of other, I think Death Becomes Her we were doing at the time. Mm-hmm. A Star Trek, it was Undiscovered Country. I think Joe Pasquale was my roommate. So, you know, seeing him doing his little meta blobby stuff. And then I had to get home. I had a newborn back in Massachusetts. So, so when I went back to Massachusetts, now what's the order of this? Right. I somehow found out that Doug Trumbull, who everybody knows, was setting up another production in Western Massachusetts that he had done the Back to the Future ride, theme park stuff. And this was a whole line. I did a lot of that work after that. So he was setting up the thing for the Luxor Hotel complex in Vegas, the big pyramid hotel, to do three very different, highly technically advanced, never been done before ride films. So
yeah, that's so cool.
So then I get to at least just move my then wife and newborn just 2 hours from Central Mass out to Western Mass to the Berkshires. So we moved out there, got an apartment, worked on that for a couple of years. And that was just, I got to build a department called Image Engineering. It was basically the precursor of what was going to be known as pre-visualization. And it was a department that was at the hub of the entire operation. So I worked closely with the art directors to then realize their sketches in 3D, work with Doug, do 3D pre-visualization of flying and camera and lenses, all using Alias on SGIs, and then translate that to the model department through stereolithography models, which is, this is 1992, so doing 3D printing in 1992, to physically make models to then be duplicated with molding techniques on set to shoot these 8th and 16th scale miniatures, and also send the 3D camera moves that I did with Doug to the motion control gantry camera system and to the Kleiser-Walczak group, who were doing CG for Elements to comp-. And it was just, it's just incredible.
So that must have meant over time, like either both in your maybe work at ILM as a technical assistant, but maybe too in your master's degree program, like you clearly had developed that muscle for sort of the programmatic end of like taking and translating data and feeding one pipe, connecting it to another. No.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. It was, that left brain. I never liked that analogy. I don't know if it's actually accurate. The left brain, right brain, you know, creative and technical.
Sure.
Equally brought to bear, you know, same in your experience, I'm sure.
Were they doing stuff at the Trumbull? Were they doing for that ride film? Were they even taking, assets that were part of that those camera paths and motion control, were they taking that and using it to generate you know, hydraulic actuator movement in, you know, the actual ride that you would sit in?
Like, oh yeah, yeah,
because that's really early for that kind of work.
It
too,
was,
that's
yeah,
pretty interesting.
Yep. Doug was a real pioneer in that, and he's a friend now. I've worked with him quite a bit, and I'm really lucky to have that connection with him, because he's such a visionary, and you can see recent interviews with him that he's been doing with like the VES Society and talking about, I mean, the impact that this one man has had from 2001 when he was in his early 20s through completely saving and pulling off Star Trek the Motion Picture in the most amazing way, and Blade Runner and everything else.
A highly underrated Star Trek movie.
Oh, I love that film. Yeah, no, I love it to death. You should see,
it's one of the most Star Trek of the Star Trek movies in a way.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I encourage everyone out there, look on Amazon. You can get the brand new book that just came out, The Art and Visual Effects of Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that in there. I've been wanting to pick up a copy just to see some of that artwork would be really fun.
It's so worth it.
It's amazing, too, that Trumbull's been so successful in. I mean, obviously, he's been hugely successful. He's had such a huge career, but he's really been kind of just his own deal. Like, he's operating out of Massachusetts, and, like, that's just his jam. And it hasn't had any, being so far from, you know, Hollywood has had, or California even, has really not had any deterrence on his success, which speaks, I think, volumes to his, you know, his significance technically and creatively in the field.
Well, it's true. And it's, you know, having that kind of icon as a personal mentor and friend, it's not much different on a different level than what George Lucas did and Francis Ford Coppola, right? So obviously I worked for and with George, but never enough to be friends. But the fact that George and Francis left LA for the basically similar reasons, to just get out of Hollywood and work independently to different levels of success. Just being outside of that machine and being independent and not wanting or liking the Hollywood system.
So you were there for a few years, it looks like, and then you came back to California? Is that...
So while at Trumbull, we wrapped the Luxor project, and another mentor of mine then was a visual effects supervisor on that project was Joel Hynek. And he's a name, not so household, but he's a brilliant, brilliant... breakthrough visual effects supervisor and the nicest guy in the world, still very active today. He worked with R. Greenberg to do the Predator camouflage effect optically.
Oh, right.
At Greenberg. And he also worked on Lady Hawk. And he won the Visual Effects Academy Award as VFX soup on what was the Robin Williams film at the same time of the Matrix with the paint.
The paint, yeah. What Dreams May
Come. What Dreams May Come, right. So anyway.
Yeah, Karen Ansel, I know, worked on that show.
Yeah, so he was getting test shots to bid on other films, including, it was just before Matrix and What Dreams May Come were pitched, but Judge Dredd, the first one was Stallone.
Stallone.
And he said, hey, T-Man, I'm there's this company that is thinking about starting up in LA and they want me to be a VFX soup. What do you think? And we talked about, you know, life and family and career and all this stuff. And here's this extremely experienced VFX soup becoming my friend, asking my advice. And I said, well, what is this operation? He says, oh, your old boss, Scott Ross, wants to start up this VFX shop in LA and call it Digital Domain. So I somehow Scott called me, Scott Ross, and hired me to be one of the first employees at DD in, this is now early 93.
Yeah, and so this is Scott Ross and Stan Winston and Jim Cameron, right?
And Jim Cameron, right. So they formed Digital Domain.
And was it on Rose at that same place?
Yeah, on the corner across from the Rose Cafe, just a block from Venice Beach.
Yeah, the Firehouse Cafe, right?
Yeah.
Or is that what it is? The Firehouse Cafe?
That's right.
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's true. So
and that weird clown, that weird animatronic clown.
Yeah, was that the Chiat Day advertising building? I think might have been that one.
Right.
But that got me to LA. So we started DD, you know, empty warehouse, sweeping out the dust, rolling in the machines.
Well, that must have been really exciting because that's kind of a new venture. It seems like in your career at that point was like really something that was like a true startup. Like it was really ground up, like building everything from scratch.
It was, you know, one of my contributions was going up with Matt, we went up to a warehouse in Burbank that were storing old mothballed stand-up arcade games and buying a couple of those and bringing them down to the lobby to say, that's the most important thing. You work on the render farm. We've got, we want to have, you know, yeah. So it was great because it was still the transition. There were tons of practical effects going on. So again, Doug Smith, who had worked on Star Wars as a cameraman, who was the motion control cameraman with that I worked with at Luxor, was hired to come out and do work on True Lies that we did later. I did some early, very early tests on Judge Dredd, but DD didn't get that project. We did The Color of Night. Was the very, very first one we did at DD.
Oh, right. Okay.
A Bruce Willis film, all 2D. Yeah. And then we did True Lies and Interview with a Vampire simultaneously. Those are the first two big VFX.
And those were big, and True Lies was huge with that sequence at the end and the bridge and the Harrier jet and all that and the heat distortion. I remember that was a big thing. People were like, oh, it looks so real.
Yeah, and that's some of the shots. I did that sequence of the Harrier taking off off of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Karen Galikas might have finaled some of the missile shots at the end, blowing up the causeway. It was a really tight team. I mean, there might have been a dozen of us, I guess, in total.
Yeah, small team and, like, you know, effects shot-wise, probably not a huge shot count, but something where it really starts to have, you've got those kind of hard surface models and then some kind of effects animation style stuff with the missile trails. And I think that's, you know, it's definitely, and some environmental stuff too, I think, right? With, although some of that was miniature, I think, right? Blowing up the bridge and.
Yes. Yeah. And the U-Haul truck doing that really happy accident flip at the end. I think they actually filmed that in Florida. In the Keys, just to have good lighting. And in the back parking lot, you know, they set up giant scale miniatures of the facades of the building and probably a quarter scale model of the Harrier with the Gatling gun blowing away. This is in the parking lot, you know, like.
What a fun show. How cool.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. So, but it was still that transition of very practical effects and not. And even then, I think the script for Avatar was going around. And Titanic was going around.
Really, even way back then, Avatar was already something that had been written.
Yep, and basically, you know, continuously shelved because it wasn't technically possible.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Jim Cameron was just too far ahead.
Now, so I'm literally just walking through your LinkedIn page here because it's amazing how many places you've worked for a while helping set things up. And you went from there to Warner Brothers, is that?
Yeah, so.
And you worked with John Dykstra?
Yeah, very closely. So this time in the early 90s, the very experienced senior visual effects supervisors like Joel Hynek, like John Dykstra, like John Bruno, so many others, but a small handful of them, they had no experience in this computer, you know, this graphics stuff. They were super brilliant VFX soup. So they were wide-eyed and open-minded to say, teach me, you know, what a pixel is. And I was just the guy to do that. So, you know, Warner Brothers approached me to open up a digital effects division in-house, which we did. We called it Warner Brothers Imaging Technology, which eventually became Warner Digital later.
But
WBIT, we pronounced it Wabbit. So Warner Brothers.
Well, that's clever.
But it was so brilliant because it was all in-house projects. So it was tests on, you know, I did a one-off shot for a Police Academy movie. I did all kinds of proof of concept stuff for films that were never made. Good Dog Carl. And I did a bunch of hand restoration 16 millimeter frame sequences for Jimi Hendrix for the 25th anniversary of the Woodstock movie.
That my 17-year-old son would freak out knowing that. I think he's a huge Jimi Hendrix fanatic.
It was just, and that just, my personality was just so infectious and in some sense impatient too. So You know, if I do the same thing more than twice, I'm just, you know, let me out of here. I've got
to. You're ready to move on to something new. I mean, that's kind of cool, though, that Warner's set that up and that you were able to kind of, you know, really participate in getting that structured. I'm surprised that that hasn't become more the norm, where the studios, I mean, I guess there's some of it you see in television, but they do always stay kind of like these somewhat separate satellite companies or satellite divisions. Maybe there's some tax or write-off purposes for doing that, you know. But it seems like so smart for a studio to have an in-house, especially for a shot, like a one-off shot or something, or some kind of dirt removal or cleanup or know, booger removal or whatever it might be.
Well, right? Of course, that was the old ways, you know, back in the golden era of Hollywood. They would, all of their in-house matte painting and miniatures and effects and stuff, it was all, you know, on the lot at Paramount. It's just their, it was their own in-house people. There was no such thing as, you know, production companies that you would sub out to. And with digital, you know, Warner's tried it. It became more to digital. I think Dinosaur pretty much put them out of business in that respect. But, you know, Sony, I was there at when Sony ImageWorks got started in
So when did Ken Ralston come after you were there, or while you were there?
About the same time. It was already started because they had moved into the new facility, and I came on as an animation consultant for Anaconda.
Oh, right on.
Because it was really hard. Animating snakes is really hard. They were doing James and the Giant
especially
Peach.
Then. I'm sure that kind of system to create that kind of sort of slithering wave animation, that would be really challenging, I think, back then.
It was. So that's, and at the same time, I realized there was so much incredibly cool stuff going on, and there was so much money being paid, which was incidental. I would have done it for minimum wage, but you know, people who were coming out of any kind of undergraduate degree with any kind of ability were getting paid six figures.
Well, it was a kind of an interesting time in terms of the explosion of the possibilities and this sort of understanding of, like, well, and all these scripts too that had been sitting around for years or new scripts that were being written to try to take advantage of, hey, could we do this? Could we try this? Like, maybe we could do, you know, tornadoes. Maybe we could do a snake, you know? And I think that really bred a kind of a real renaissance, and it led to a host of really exciting opportunities for, like, new technical achievements that people had yet to figure out how to do, really. So it was really this moment of and period of incredible synthesis of you know, technology and you know, the art and the technology kind of starting to weave together in some great and interesting ways.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better. The mid-90s was just this, just as you said it, just an explosion of people going, wait, we can do what?
And suddenly things that were never before thought doable were, oh, yeah, you know, we probably could do that.
and
so cool.
And being at the high level in Warner Brothers, internally, all the Warner Brothers directors who were being contracted would come in and talk to me and say, okay, I've got this script. So, like, Sam Raimi came in, you know, hey, I got to talk to you about how to do a computer graphic snowman that talks and walks. And so he'd sit down and bullshit with Sam Raimi for 45 minutes about, you know, pros and cons and challenges and stuff. And,
that's really exciting too, and I think that speaks to something, you know, maybe on a larger scale too, that's kind of interesting to think about at kind of a meta level, is just you were really in the right place at the right time,
right.
And your sort of nascent interests, maybe as a kid, being interested in film, being interested in computers and technology, and kind of having those interests coalesce at the time that they did. It was sort of out there in the ether, but you were kind of an early adopter of thinking about some of that stuff, and had the good fortune, I think, too, of, you know, really landing in a space and time, and pursuing it doggedly too, but where you were able to, kind of carve out an important kind of niche for yourself too, where it's like you were that guy that people would come and talk to. That's really exciting.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just the serendipity of, you know, going to breakfast at a diner with John Dykstra and having him say, so, you know, what's this? How do you make pixels? How do we, you know, how are we gonna do pre-visualization on this Batman movie? And just working that out with these icons who are just, because they're as infectiously interested as I am about the possibilities of this new technology. Because, you know, these are just brilliant people who are just, it's just another tool. It's like, oh, great, give me another tool.
Yeah, yeah.
To tell stories.
So, and the pre-viz stuff that you were doing, was that like, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, now we kind of take it for granted, and, you know, we're using real-time rendering systems. Right. We're doing a lot of previs and doing some even, you know, live on set. There's some previs that happens, mm-hmm. I know. But was that all done, like, just kind of real low-res style graphics with, like, you know, sort of characters sliding around? Mm-hmm. And was it more about just sort of, like, moving storyboards more than anything else?
Yes, although 3D. So, yeah. Two and a half 3D, you know, taking 2D storyboards, adding 3D elements. It eventually, Colin, oh man, I'm getting old. What was Colin's last name? I hired him as a fresh college grad to work for me in the image engineering department back with Trumbull. And he spun off and he started a company called the Pixel Liberation Front. PLF.
Right. Yep.
Which I think was
became a whole industry.
Oh yeah, it was huge. And then the Third Floor, of course, is, you know, just iconic in the quality that they produce, doing you know, previews and so much more. But yeah, back then it was just a natural application of that and early digital stuff.
What's so sensible in big effect sequences? I mean, I remember as a kid watching a making of, you know, one of the first Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been Jedi or something, and they were literally using Star Wars toys and a, you know, cheap video camera on, you know, some cardboard to try to frame up and figure out how they were going to do, you know, like the speeder bike
sequence. That's right, like with a little lipstick cam, a little tiny little camera poking through on the end of a stick.
But you realize how much that kind of that visualization process, how important that is to really getting everybody on the same page, to be able to understand, you know, kind of what we're trying to achieve. What are we going for? How is this going to look? And, you know, concept art can take you so far, and can sometimes fill that void. Traditional storyboards can do that. But then that previsualization, a generation of assets, which has gotten so sophisticated now, where they're even generating assets that can then be passed off to be sort of souped up for final assets. I mean, it becomes such a really sensible and kind of logical way to proceed with, certainly with really complex sequences.
Yeah, that's very true. And even today, I tell my students to not use the computer as a thinking tool, a experimentation tool. That's more for pencil and paper and paint and clay and photography, and where you can do, you know, a thousand iterations in an hour. And find your happy accidents, lots of failures and throw away tons of stuff, and then go to the computer and start iterating. And I'll probably get some pushback on that, but
I don't know. I think it's true. You know, I just did a talk with of one of the art directors from Pixar, not for this, but for a thing at my school, and he was talking about, I can't remember his last name off the top of my head, Bert. That'll come to me later. But he was talking about and showed a bunch of stuff in his talk about Pixar doing so much physical R&D. Like, he was talking about, it was so cool. He was talking about Inside Out and how they were trying to develop the look and the aesthetic for some of the inside world, you know, the sort of internal world that they create, where the different mood parts of the young girl are sort of
anger and happy
anthropomorphized. As these emotions, and they were literally doing like cutouts, like physical cutouts of different kinds of paper, and shining light through them and trying to figure out, like, what is this going to look like? And, you know, really engaging in this kind of physical activity that then informed the things that they would do in the computer. And I found that to be so heartening too, in that it really was about community and engagement mm-hmm. and experimentation, and really kind of bringing the computer in, like you say, not as the thinking tool, but kind of as the final tool to help sort of,
right,
you know, put the images on screen. And I think that is really important, that tactile experimentation.
Yeah, and you talked about timing before. Again, having these mentors become friends who had done such brilliant, monumental breakthrough stuff without computers, you know, whether it was Joel Heineck with his experience, Dykstra, and at ILM, of course, the greatest,
yeah,
Dennis, you know, being our leader, you know, I still remember we were talking about shader development for Jurassic pre-production, even way back in 91. And he had a maquette from the model shop of a brachiosaur, and he took it and he says, "Team man, let's go outside in the parking lot. I want to show you how real light falls on real material." So he just take this, you know, painted, bumped, realistic dinosaur and hold it up to the light and rotate it and say, "Now look, do this," and then go back on the computer and write a shader. Don't go into a dark room and write math.
Yeah, that's that thing about really seeing.
Right.
And
right.
Like, and really using your eye and really being keen in how you view and observe
right.
the physical world, you know?
Right. That's why I think photography is so important, and so many of our friends are great photographers, because you just,
yeah.
that's all about seeing, right? It's just observing the world and walking in the woods and looking up and getting down on your belly and seeing stuff at different scales and how light plays off surfaces. It's so important.
So now you, after Sony, you came back to ILM. How did that come about?
I did. So after Warner Brothers got up and running, there was just so much going on, and I was getting so many challenging offers to solve problems that I said, I've got to be independent. I've got to have the freedom to do six projects at a time and hire some friends to work for me. And so I started up a consulting production company called Digital Photography, FAUX Photography.
So right on.
French our French friends will get that, Digital Photography. So I did like the original Bud Frog commercial of the Budweiser frogs, as a subcontract from DD. So Digital Domain got this job. They couldn't handle it. They're like, "T-Man, I heard you are starting your own startup spin out company. Do this." So I did that project in-house at DD, but as an independent, and then spread out from there. Did work on Judge Dredd, did work on a ton of other independent films, Cutthroat Island, worked with Jeff Okun a lot as a BFX soup. And then a couple of kids from the Midwest had this Christmas card that went around that was just tearing people up, and they wanted to pitch it to Comedy Central as a series. And they heard I could like problem solve using this new computer graphics stuff. So Matt and Trey said, "Okay, well, here's a pilot for the show we want to call South Park." And we shot it with downshooting animation stand construction paper cutouts.
No kidding.
But it takes 6 months to make 22 minutes. And,
yeah.
and Comedy Central said, "Well, go away when you can do that in 2 days." So I alone they gave me a dope sheet of a scene, of a sequence, and a plastic baggie, which is on the shelf right behind me, a plastic baggie full of cutout head and mouth shapes.
Uh-huh.
And I just, by eyeball, hand modeled the sequence in Alias, ray traced it for nice shadows, added all kinds of kind of aberration stuff, animated it at 24 frames per second, converted it 3:2 pull down out to VHS at 30, and showed it to Comedy Central with Matt and Trey, which sold South Park. This was the summer of 96.
Wow, no way.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I did not know that. That is amazing.
So Terrence and Philip, I still to this day, I don't know who Philip is, but my daughters think that it's quite funny that, you know, daddy's named after.
Wow, that is so cool. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they animate most of those episodes now in Maya, don't they?
They probably do. I think the first breakthrough that they did, because they sold the series and said, "Great, now we got to, you've got to build a studio for us, because you've done that before. You know, you're at DD, you started up Warner Digital, you've done your own independent, so, you know, build our animation production pipeline studio to produce the South Park TV series." here in LA, and we have to find a way to automate the lip syncing, which was the first big thing that we needed to, to automate it, not hand keyframe it like I did.
Right.
And that same week, I got a call from ILM to say, we're crewing up for a super secret subgroup within ILM to do the Star Wars Special Edition trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Would you come back up to San Rafael and do that? So I said, I can be there tomorrow. Let me tell my family we're packing up. And, you know, good luck, Matt and Trey, but, you know, you're farting Canadian humor. Good luck with that. It's, you know, and that wasn't.
Still, though, what a cool thing to have been involved in, like, just as a, even as a one-off little bit. Like,
oh, I
that
know.
Is so.
Oh,
I had no idea that. I didn't see that on your thing. I had no idea you did that. That is so cool.
Yeah. So that got me back up to San Rafael. And that's
where and so that was when George was doing the special editions of A New Hope, Empire, and Jedi. Were you on all of those?
Shows? That's right. Yeah. So that I went up in. So I remember it being September '96 when I did the test for Comedy Central with Matt and Trey. That was September '96, and I went up immediately. It must have been October, November, end of '96, back to ILM to do Star Wars, Empire, and Jedi. Yeah, the re-release special editions of the original three movies. I did not.
And that, I always say that's like so cool. I got to work on all three of those in little bits and pieces, doing some comp and some roto,
right,
and some 2D paint stuff. I think at the time.
Yeah.
And I always tell people that I'm a time traveler when I talk to students, and they say, "What do you mean?" And, so, well, because I got to work on the movie that inspired me to want to go to work in the movies when I was a kid.
How cool
as an
is that,
adult,
right?
You know, which is just such a weird, I think those of us who got a chance to work on those, even in just some tangential way, are so lucky if that was in any way something that motivated you to want to pursue a career in visual effects. To have that opportunity was so amazing and so fun.
Oh, yeah. So when that phone call came, I don't care what else I was doing. There was no way that was right. There's no way that was a
kid. Yeah, I'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll be like, when can I be? Now, when did you get to ILM? Were you there just in 96 or were you there before that?
No, you know, I started as an intern in 1992. I was at San Francisco State as a film student.
Okay.
And I applied for the internship three times, and two times I didn't get it, but I was never one to be deterred. And the third time I applied, I got the internship, and I was an intern in the art department, which was really exciting in 92. There was a lot of fun shows going on. Jurassic wasn't yet finished, and so there was some, you know, interesting. So we were there at the same time. There's some crossover, I think. And then I went from there to I answered the phones for a year, which is
excellent.
Was a great experience. And I learned everybody's name, everybody's extension, and everyone's department, like, and who reported to who. And I knew the producers and directors and studio people in LA. They all knew my name, which was really cool.
Great.
And and then moved into eventually doing, I think, roto first and some paint, and then onto compositing. And I think by the time by the time those special editions got started, I was doing more compositing work. So it was mostly I was there for when that all got started, and was just shocked that they were even going to do it, but it seemed so exciting. And the big sequence, of course, was the addition of the Jabba character. I think was the one that seemed like the one that people had seen the previous shots of before, and that's
with the guy in the big
been worked
furry
on.
The big furry coat.
Yes, some like Scottish guy or something.
In the hangar with the Falcon. Well, you remember, because so hanging around, our crew, you'll remember, was in that one separate building that had separate secure key access.
Yep.
Over by the Circuit City side of the parking lot. And that's where I brought in a VHS tape on a cart, you know, an AV cart to show to the Star Wars Special Edition crew the South Park pilot.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And that would just brought production to a halt because, you know, only eight people could crowd around the monitor at one time. And the producer would be like, "What the hell is going on? Everybody, get back to work."
Well, and then a couple people, who was it? Was it Corey Rosen and Scott Liebricht? And they did that spoof of South Park. Did you see?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, like... yeah. Because it was Scott. Yeah, Scott was the lead on that. That was his baby, I believe. That was Scott's. and he was in the art department, right, Scott?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, oh, okay, so you did South Park, so I want to do this the same way. And it was about the spirit of Spawn. Right. So it was about right. Spawn. I was on that crew. So it was like, you can see me in there. I'm sitting right behind Spaz and Christoph and Habib. I'm sitting right behind with, I didn't have a beard then. I had my baseball cap on, looking all dismissive.
That is one of the funniest little like insider jokes.
I know.
That one still to this day, when I see that, it cracks me up with the Christoph is so bizarre.
Yeah, coming
something
in
something about a lumber yard. And...
yeah, just take out half the sticks, Habib. No, I'm going to tweak the speculum or the HK, yeah. KSKD ratio and spaz. Just take out half the fucking sticks.
You can't forget it once you see it. It's like it's embedded in your brain.
I know, it's true. No.
So what kind of stuff did you do on the special editions? Were you doing like technical director? Were you doing animation?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was a senior TD. It was before I was doing sequence souping stuff. And I begged and begged and begged. I could not find a way to touch a pixel on Star Wars. So I did not get to touch any shot, on Star Wars Episode 4. No. So I did a bunch of big sequences on Empire. It was the, Approach to Cloud City.
George Hull, right? Didn't he do a lot of the boards and designs for some of the Cloud City approach?
He probably did. I'm trying to think. I had more direct contact with the art department of Phantom Menace when we were doing more original art direction stuff. So the approach, flying the Falcon into Cloud City, basically was... Mm-hmm. was the big sequence that I worked on. I think Robert Parrish.
It must have been fun, like matching that look and stuff of that kind of real sort of Sherbert kind of sky.
Sherbert is right. A magic hour. Yeah. And then interesting watching The Mandalorian now, because I've told everybody who's asked me in the last 30 years, no, Boba Fett is dead because I killed him. That was the sequence I did, basically, of adding the tentacles and the beak to the Sarlacc in Return of the Jedi, including the shot.
That added a lot, I think. That made that thing more menacing. It didn't look like a big rubber hole.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, with the beak and biting on Boba Fett's leg as he dragged him down, and then the burp shot afterwards. So I did all those. I did all those shots on Jedi, and including actually significantly the. So I did the very first digital reproductions of blaster bolts and lightsabers.
Cool. Right on.
That I know of at the time, I'm pretty sure, because that was the first sequence that had, blaster bolts going off and lightsabers that had to be redone digitally. All the other elements.
So can you talk a little bit about your lightsaber technique? Like, what was the thing that really sold it, that made it work?
Yeah, I can actually. I actually use this as an example for my students. So you remember Tom Rossiter?
Yep, of course.
I love him to death. He's just so crotchety and, get off my lawn, kid.
What a brilliant guy, too. Oh, so smart.
He is wicked. And so he optically composited these shots 30 years before, or 25 years before, whatever it was at the time. And here he is recompositing them digitally. He's like, son of a bitch, you know what? I got to do this again. But so, so we had the original plates rescanned of, like Jabba's barge, sail barge, and the desert, of course. And then for some reason, I think because the original elements were all hand effects animated, right? The lightsabers with optical tricks, it was just easier or only possible to do digitally. So I forget, I don't remember the moment if it was Tom or Dennis or somebody else, or we just analyzed, we just broke it down. Because back then TDs did everything. So we got all the scanned film elements, we wrote all the scripts to tie them together. We created all of the assets from the specialists who were like the modelers and the view painters. We would write the shaders on top of that. We would light it. We would composite it all as a TD. So the key to the lightsabers and the blaster bolts was using three elements. One was the core, almost white center, hot. Mm-hmm. And then two was the big overglow of the main color, red, blue, green.
Yeah.
And then, actually, four. But so the third one was in the outer glow around all of that to tie it together.
And these were all additive, right? Additive layers. So you'd get...
Right.
Like an optical, like a super white.
That's kind. Right. And at the time, there were so many. You have the A over B, B over A, you know, additive, multiple, you know, all the different... steps. I wrote a little guide for doing this that hung around.
I'm certain that I read it.
Yeah, because you know we would always do that, right? We would modify the do-all script and you know with a little quote.
Yeah,
with our own little thing. So and then whenever there was an impact or like if lightsabers crossed each other or a blaster bolt hit, then that would be a fourth element. You know, that would be like the yellow. Kind
it was
of
like a
flash.
Yeah, yellow or a greenish
right.
kind of.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's so cool. That's so fun. Like because that's still such a huge thing, and now of course you see all these. I don't know if you ever see those like Corridor Digital YouTube channel where these guys do their own effects, and they made some funny ones with Boston Dynamics robots fighting back, and they've done some fun lightsaber ones. But
oh, you'll have to send me those.
There's so many things like that's that funny. Now that are just so well done, and you could tell they're keen observers into how a lot of that stuff was done back in the day.
Yeah, just yeah. Well,
that's
thrill,
cool.
The thrill, and you were there.
And the Phantom Menace, though, then that starts up. And was that right after George finished the Jedi re-release, or was it? I don't
even remember no, that timeline. No, because we did. So I was a sequence soup on Phantom Menace. We did Small Soldiers between then, right? That was around 98-ish.
Yeah, I was on that show.
Yeah, that was a brilliant show. That was so much fun.
That was with Kim Bromley.
Yeah, absolutely. The one and only.
The Queen of France.
I know. I got to listen to that podcast of yours. I listened to Ty Rubin's just earlier, which was great, by the way.
Yeah, he's got many a good tale to tell for sure.
But I think, what else did we do between? Well, so for everyone listening, Matt will be able to tell you. There'd be multiple shows going on at once at ILM. So you would be, we would be on Small Soldiers, but there'd be like Deep Rising and you know
John Burton was on that one, I think, right?
And yeah, or you know, then the Men in Black would be showing, and you know, you could sometimes sneak over and into those dailies, you know, and see what was going on the other shows.
Yeah, really, as that digital kind of explosion occurred after Jurassic, where, like we were talking about, where all these scripts are getting greenlit and all these opportunities come up, the number of shows in-house grew, the number of employees that were being sought, like you were saying earlier, too, like greeting people right out of school. It really just grew and grew and grew to the point where there were numerous shows happening simultaneously in the entire facility, at least in terms of ILM, and I think this was also happening, of course, down in LA and elsewhere, but all of that just kept expanding and growing, and it was this real it was sort of the manifest destiny moment of computer graphics or something, this big expansion.
Yeah, and there was so many breakthroughs going on every one of those crews, you know, like Dennis Turner and The Mummy. You know, the stuff that they did with that digital creature was just insane. You know, that you're like, you hear about, did you see what they showed dailies over on Mummy today? Oh, my God.
And you were starting to see, too, new hardware, new different less expensive silicon graphics machines, different kinds of faster graphics cards, new software tools that were more representative of, a more modern style GUI software where you were able to do and see so much more so quickly. So all of this was happening really, really fast.
Yeah, that's right. It was about then, because you would remember all of the original text-based compositing and lighting tools that we talked about briefly earlier suddenly got GUIs. They got interfaces. So
yeah, it went from like iComp to
Comp Time, and there was iRender to, you know, I don't know what they started renaming it to. And then I did Spawn. That must have been before Phantom Menace, maybe. I forget what year Spawn was. So that's when, so they split off to do that as an external project and subbed it back to ILM. And they kicked us out into, we're in a bunch of trailers in the parking lot.
Yep.
Overflow doing the Spawn movie. And then, yeah, so the, and then Phantom Menace was in the first new Star Wars movie in whatever, 25 years.
Yeah, and do you remember how, with regards to that show, like how you were tapped to come on board there, or was that?
Yeah, well, you probably remember too, if, you know, once you're a senior, whatever, senior TD, senior compositor, the first next opportunity you would get is as a sequence supervisor. So that was mm-hmm. you know, put in charge, you know, leading a team of people, in my case, other TDs, and you're given a sequence. So on Phantom Menace, I was a sequence sup of we call it the Stampede sequence. So it was basically everything from when the landing robot, the droid landing ships came down onto Naboo.
Oh, right, right.
And offloaded those giant racks of droids. And then we encountered Jar Jar. So another dubious distinction, right, on my resume.
Well, you know.
Sorry, world. And he was that annoying in dailies even back then. All the way up until my souping responsibilities ended when they dove underwater. And then there was an overlap. And then I worked on whoever the sequence soup was for the underwater city, and I did a ton of compositing on the underwater city shots when they right. after they first dove underwater. And that was just
that's cool. And did you stay just through the end of that show and before you?
I did. Well, you might remember. So the show was so big that they had three visual effects supervisors leading. They probably had 1,000 shots each. So
yeah, it was the largest shot count of any show ever by a factor of I don't know many
huge. So I was on Dennis's crew, Dennis Muren, and I think Scott Squires and John Knoll I think were the other two VFX soups on.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Episode one, and each had a whole pyramid, gigantic structure of team under them. So again, with lots of close mentoring with Dennis on a whole bunch of analog digital mashup stuff, with going to the shooting stage, stepping in a waiting pool with a digital cam and Luma keying
it off.
That's
the thing, you know, there's so much miniature work on that show too. I think it was the most miniatures on any movie that ILM had ever done, and I feel like people don't really remember that part of
the whole pod raising sequence.
And
did you get to work on the Saber stations?
You know, no, I never did work over in that area. I mean, that's where Chad.
Who were the
names? Some names escape me right now. I'm getting my age is showing, but
Pablo.
I never worked over there. Pablo was over there. Yeah, that was, I think, around the time he came, maybe, or maybe he'd come a little earlier than that.
Yeah, because I think he was
Chad Taylor, I think, is who I was thinking of.
Maybe so. But a lot of just 2D, 2.5D, putting together a lot of traditional stuff.
And the Saber, just for anybody who doesn't know, was essentially like a customized, modified version of a flame system, right? It was like a high-speed compositing tool set where had a lot of expensive hardware making it run fast.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think
and the people who were operators doing that were, you know, highly skilled, highly paid, certainly in commercial houses all around the country at that point. But in terms of the work done in movies on those systems, it was a rarefied group for sure.
So, I worked all the way through that. And then they were crewing the next round of shows. And I didn't mention my whole life from childhood to then, I was and still am a hardcore gamer. So video games.
Oh, right on.
So so player, creator, a lot of that time in the mid-90s when I was running my own digital photography thing, I was doing pre-rendered cinematics, visual effects supervising on in-game content. Maxis EA subbed out to me to produce all of the in-game content for SimCity 4.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So I hired the entire team, put it all together, all under digital photography moniker, created all that stuff. So round about 99-ish, there was rumors somebody from Microsoft called and said, super top secret, we're developing this thing that we're going to call the Xbox, and it's going to revolutionize the gaming world. It's going to be in the living room and blow people away and, you know, change the paradigm of content delivery into the living room. And so
That wasn't really hyperbole. I think they were. It was true.
No, they were. No, I wasn't being sarcastic there at all. I was like, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. Did I sound sarcastic? No, it's true. And now they were very upfront with that. We're going to lose money on the hardware. This is about getting a pipe into the living room for delivering content. And we want you to come up and lead one of the first titles on this and help us with the development of the graphics and all that. So
did you have a connection to somebody that was there, like that you knew already? Like, was there some, like, who, how did they find you?
I think so. And it's because it was on like literally the same day that I was crewed on The Perfect Storm.
Right. Okay.
And they said, you know, so you're going to be helping comp and render and simulate the, they call it crest foam. So the edges of waves for the next 9 months. So no offense to that team, that Breakthrough Film, but I was like, okay, I'm not interested in that at all. And I'm going to go. So I left ILM the second time to go. And I think it was a connection through, there was a third party developer that I ended up being the director of development, co-writing a script, Bruce Lee title, working with the Bruce Lee estate, Linda Lee Caldwell, and, all of Bruce Lee's original students, as a first party title for the Xbox launch. So that was working with Microsoft Research and building a studio in, was it Novato? I think it was in Novato, just north of San Rafael.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not up in Washington.
No, it was a lot of flying on in and out of Burbank Airport, back and forth.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
Yeah. And parallel with all of this, I was volunteering at SIGGRAPH.
Well, now that's a really interesting part of your CV too, is your involvement with SIGGRAPH, like as conference chair. I know I saw your keynote, I believe, in LA at one of the SIGGRAPHs.
Yeah, 2010.
It must have been. Yeah. But that's really an amazing level of engagement that is, I shouldn't say a thankless task. That's not right. But it's a real it's a professional service kind of activity. And had you been going to SIGGRAPH for, you know, since it kind of in the early days? Did you go to the one at the party at the Nixon Library?
I did. And it's not entirely thankless. After, you know, 25 years of volunteering, I got a plaque. So that was the.
Oh, well, that's good. Plaques always nice. Looks good on the wall.
It does. Yeah, I think my first SIGGRAPH was 1988 in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
We got to have a whole talk about the Timothy
what
Leary.
I'm curious, what do you think about, the Timothy Leary.
And
sorry.
Fishbone was playing music and the Snake Charmer outside, and that was a party.
Yeah, that was a Clint Goldman special, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, now, I'm curious, what do you think about SIGGRAPH going forward with the current state of things in the pandemic? I know we had the first sort of virtual SIGGRAPH this last summer. Do you have any insight or any thoughts into how that might function in the future?
Well, I think not too differently from every other conference, literally in the world, that has to do the same thing. I've been very involved in helping to program and advise FMX since about 99. That's a conference in Stuttgart, Germany every spring. That's just absolutely brilliant. More VFX focused than research. And the Vue conference more recently in the same way. And they all have to just survive. They have to, and I think all of them have pulled off. I didn't experience SIGGRAPH too much virtually this summer. I was just way too busy.
I signed up to go and I went to one or two things, but I had the same. You know, it was tough. It was a big ask to do it that way. And I do think there's so much, for me personally anyway, there's so much about physically being there and like running into people and
right.
Not having that did change it some, I think.
And I think that's the biggest loss, is that you and I don't get a chance to bump into each other in the hallways of SIGGRAPH and say, dude.
That community part of it is so, so important.
Yeah. Yeah, because I use the analogy with my students that if we were talking about growing up in the aeronautics industry and we're engineers working on airplanes and stuff, and you go to the convention and Orbel and Wilbur Wright are there in the cafe, and you could say, hey, so remind me again how you, you know, launched the Kitty Hawk and you invented the certain angle of the wing and stuff, because the people who founded this industry of ours, you know, Ed Catmull and Jim Blinn and and Turner Whitted and Alvy Ray Smith, they're still very much alive and active in this industry. And it's just, it's a really young, mature at the same time, right?
Yeah.
This community of ours. And everybody's altruistic and fun. It's, you know, it's why I love you doing this podcast. And I just wanted to contribute a voice to tell everybody how much fun we had and we're continuing to have. And everybody's helping
really
each other
is,
out.
I think it is such an exciting, and it's an industry whose work, whether you're interested in games or visual effects or architecture or, you know, some other form of visualization, medical visualization, whatever it might be, there's just, or even, you know, software development, you know, at the most fundamental level, there's so many ways in. It's such a porous industry. There's so many opportunities for people to really find their niche and find the things that they really love. And the most amazing thing are just those tangential connections that you wind up finding that you have to another area, another industry. I always talk about with my students, you know, well, just how I think it's so interesting how like you can be working on a, you know, building a model of a of an eye for a character, and you maybe you've never taken an anatomy class, but suddenly you kind of have to sort of take a crash course in the anatomy of the human eye, and you learn all the names of the parts of the eye. And it's like there's so many really fun kind of eclectic things that you sort of draw upon in efforts to either recreate something in a photorealistic way or in a stylized way or whatever it might be. And I think that that is, there's just an endless amount of creativity and I think excitement that can come from working in some capacity in this area of maybe what we could just call computer graphics or computer arts.
Well, I don't think there's, you know, I mean, filmmaking in general, but definitely what you and I do in the visual effects side of it is for the insatiably curious, right? There's no there's no better thing to do, I don't think, just to be able to collaborate with, just as you said, just such a wide, disparate pantheon of fun and crazy people, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that for me, when I look back on, in particular, I mean, I've worked at many companies as well and have had, you know, lots of different film projects I've worked on. And I think back on those early days for me at Industrial Light and Magic, when it was really getting started in this sort of computer revolution of digital visual effects and kind of those early days of development. And I just think back more than anything to the people. And the people that were there who, like you say, like that endless enthusiasm and curiosity and engagement, I feel like is something that certainly in, for, and I wanted to ask you about your work now in education, like certainly for me at the university where I teach, like that's everything, you know, is to really try to infuse that kind of curiosity and that kind of excitement in the potential of discovery, the sort of endless discovery that can occur and how much fun it really can be.
Yeah.
So how did you get into teaching? Was that always something that was on your radar or did that?
It kind of was. I mean, it's a great segue, and that's why I mentioned SIGGRAPH, because that was the my door opening for education. So I had, I was the Computer Animation Festival chair in 2006. And I took the CAF, the ET, Electronic Theater Show, on the road to a, you know, a world tour. So brought it to cities all around the world to show the
God, have fun.
The tours. Oh, it was great. I mean, going to Pixar and just showing it and talking about the filmmakers and, but mostly just having lots of fun talking with local student chapters, including Boston.
Yeah.
And at the end of the screening, it had been screened on the campus of Northeastern University in Boston. And the faculty came up to me afterwards, said, "This is amazing. This is so eye-opening, and it's so brilliant. And, you know, thank you for bringing this. And who are you? And what do you do?" And I told them, and they said, "Well, we really want to build a game design department from scratch and completely reinvent what we do with digital art here at Northeastern University." And I said, "Really? I'm kind of looking for a change of the production grind. I'd been doing it for 20 years by then. So I got hired as a full-time professor of practice to do that at Northeastern, and I stayed there for 8 years.
Doesn't Northeastern have that really interesting co-op model too?
They do. Very good. So it was this perfect place at the perfect time to bring in industry experienced people like myself to redevelop curriculum, to build programs from scratch, to work with the co-op program, which basically actively it's the 4-year undergraduate program takes 5 years because you take a full year in 2 6-month chunks on either side of your junior year to work. It's a formal internship kind of thing. So that was a real eye opener to be in a research focused tenure track institution. And I soaked that
up. I'm curious, transitioning from industry to education is an experience that I've had.
Right.
And I have some thoughts on it. I think every university and every program is certainly different in terms of their endowment, their investment, their vision of what it is that they see as viable or whatnot. I'm curious, how was that transition for you personally, coming from a really active industry engagement, moving into education? Was that pretty smooth for you?
It was and it wasn't. It was, because I got tremendous support to start up the program. And my colleagues were great for the most part, all extremely traditional photographers and painters and art historians and architects. And the best thing about Northeastern and the name of the umbrella program that I named all of this was Creative Industries. So the word Creative Industries is one that's very common overseas to basically encompass the creative potential in everything, in engineering and business and physics and music. And we had all those departments. So it's a big university. So I was able to draw upon the faculty in all those departments of physics, of business, of architecture, of music, technology, within the art department, and create this amazing things for the students.
Yeah.
And there really couldn't have been any place better to do that. The downside was, none of that was a priority to the vast majority of faculty, because it's a tenure track institution. And this isn't meant to be, disparaging on the people I worked with there or the institution. It's just not a priority. It's just, when you're when you're hired, I mean, when you're hired on a tenure track, there is no second priority. That's your only priority, is to get tenure. And unfortunately,
I think I found in higher ed, I feel like the hardest thing is they're such big institutions with such a kind of particular kind of, at times, mildly calcified focus. It's hard to steer the ship quickly in an education. And I think there's good reasons for that. But I do sometimes think in an industry like this that we've both been involved in for so long, I think in this industry, being able to find ways to be more nimble and to change and to alter curricular structures and course requirements and stuff. Some of those things that that work for accreditation don't work for the nimble nature of academia. And I find that that is the greatest obstacle in my experience in coming sort of into an area of higher ed from industry.
No, you're absolutely right. Because if the last thing anybody on tenure track wants to do is sit on a committee,
right?
Because that detracts from their only priority. So everything mechanically, staff people are not staffed because of budgetary reasons. They ask tenure track faculty to serve on all the committees, and nobody of whom wants to be in that room. So to your point, it takes years to make any kind of pivot, to make any kind of change and get approval through all these layers of Department Committee A, Department Committee B, Department Chair, Dean Committee, it just takes forever. So where I am now at SVA, School of Visual Arts, there was a little bridge. So I taught this capstone thesis class, and I one of the projects I spun out with my partner, who was the head of the architecture program, it was like 8 years ago now, I guess. We called it Building Conversation. It was a location-based mobile augmented reality project that I spun out and started a company, a startup company to do that, and got angel investors and early startups and ran that for 2 years, and then got the call from SVA, from School of Visual Arts in Manhattan, which was 5 years ago now. And
so do you live in the greater New York area now?
I do midweek during the semesters. I sublet an apartment in Midtown.
Right on.
But my main home is here in central Massachusetts, just outside of Worcester, just north of Hartford, Connecticut.
Cool.
On a dead end street with a farm next door in the woods. And it's great. So basically I work from my home office Mondays and Fridays, and I go down and work in Manhattan Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays. Of course, I haven't done that since mid-March because of COVID.
It's definitely been interesting teaching online. I do think, again, it's similar to what we were talking about with regards to SIGGRAPH and sort of FMX and the sort of conference universe, like the loss of that collegial community in the academic space, in the labs and in the hallways and stuff, that does make it challenging. But hopefully we'll come out of this in the not too distant future and be able to continue on, as they say.
I'm sure we are. So I couldn't be happier. It's amazing to be able, like you know, to be able to teach. It's just amazing to be able to have these kind of conversations every day with students, and you know, giving them that insight of happy accidents and tangential cooperation and collaboration. And I'm just, my personal project is exactly what we're talking about, the history of CG. So that's, if you go to historyofcg.com, it's the online version of, I wrote a book in the mid 90s and then did a second edition called CG 101.
Oh, wow. This looks really cool.
Thank you.
All right.
So CG 101 was basically, it's 500 plus pages of what we're just talking about, basically broken down by chapters of specialty with all kinds of tips and tricks and insider things and interviews with all of the founders of all of the early computer graphics companies. So it's really important, I think, for students to know that. And I just put it all online as kind of a third edition, if you can call it that. So History of CG is just supposed to be, it's just a personal passion project I use for teaching. So if anybody listening is interested in this stuff, and I know you are, just go in and have fun and see, like, oh, you know, I didn't know what studio made this movie. It's my favorite. And oh, I know this guy who worked on that movie. Where else did he work? And it's about the people behind the pixels.
Yeah, and that's really, I think, where my heart lies, is like with the people, for sure. And I think this is such an amazing, this is an amazing resource. It really is, just in this conversation alone today, like, I think it's clear there is a need for documenting a really, you know, a version of history of kind of the evolution of this area of the business. So I think that's really amazing. What a great resource.
And you're doing it, right? It's the people behind the pixels. That was the theme that I did for the 2010 SIGGRAPH conference that I chaired.
So it's perfect. It's perfect. We're speaking. We're of the same mind.
It is. That's why I wanted to help. Anything I can do, but I'll spread the word about this great podcast of yours, and go back and listen to the one with Kim.
Oh, thank you so much. Terrence Masson, I can't thank you enough for taking so much time today to chat with me and to share your insights and your experience. You've had an amazing and fascinating career. Where's a good place for people to go and kind of find out more about you or connect with you?
Well, they can email me directly. Just my first name dot last name at gmail.com. Terrence.Masson@gmail.com. All E's and two S's in Masson. Or my SVA email is just tmasson@sva.edu. And I would love to hear from people. I'm very active on Twitter. You can check me out there too. But we're accepting applications now for grad school. So if anyone is even passingly thinking about doing an MFA, a 2-year MFA, that's what the program I lead is all about.
I have to say it's tempting. I could see maybe leaving my job and going and getting that MFA. I never got the MFA. I got the equivalency.
Oh, well, there you go. No, it's a great program. It's a blast. So we do 2D, 3D, and experimental art. I've got 100 grad students, and they're all doing this kind of stuff because I'm telling them to just blow it up, you know, have fun, experiment, collaborate. And we've got 1,200 alumni over 35 years. So they're working at all these companies, just changing the world, man.
That's a great network too for all the students there.
So thanks for doing this. It was great to be asked, and good on you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Matt.